When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
And what she found is that they felt three times more satiated when they ate the milkshake that they thought was higher in calories, even though it was exactly the same shake. And so this is fascinating. It's not just that they reported feeling, but their body physiologically responded as if they had gotten a different product.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, the show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. How does our food environment dictate our health? Well, as it turns out, it is incredibly important. I mean, can you believe that in the 1950s and 60s, Americans had comparable obesity levels to the Europeans? And what shifted their diets and ultimately their waistlines is a number of factors, including public policy and nutrition, yes, but also the food environment, including portion sizing and the sheer number of choices involved in food consumption. And we have quite a few stories about those different portion sizing and what actually triggered that in the 1950s. And to talk with me about it today is Jack Bobo. He is the author of a brilliant book called Why Smart People Make Bad Food Choices. You can find it on Amazon and in all good bookstores online. He is also the CEO of Futurity, a food foresight company that advises companies, foundations, and governments on emerging food trends, consumer attitudes, and behaviors related to the future of food. He is very, very well researched in this subject matter, and he's even been recognized by Scientific American as one of the 100 most influential people in biotechnology. He is a thought leader and previously served as the Chief Communications Officer and Senior Vice President for Global Policy and Government Affairs at Intrexon Corporation, and he also worked at the US Department of State for 13 years as Senior Advisor for Global Food Policy. Like I said, he knows his stuff. Today, we're going to be talking about information overload in the grocery aisles and whether food labels actually do more harm than good, how decision fatigue affects your ability to eat well as how you can work around these nuances, why what you believe you could be eating can have a powerful, measurable physiological effect. This is a study that blew my mind called the Milkshake Study. Choice architecture, which is basically about how we can design deliberate food landscapes that deliver specific outcomes, and why we'd obviously want to design environments that deliver health outcomes, and also what we can learn from the infamous Google canteens that can be applied to the outside world. And trust me, I've been to these Google canteens and they are wonderful places. But I can imagine if I was working at Google for a long, extended period of time, I wouldn't be able to stop myself from eating all the wonderful, delicious food. So it's really interesting to see what they've done there and how Jack is advising them too. You're going to love this episode if you're interested in the blue sky thinking of how we design better food environments with the objective of empowering people to live healthier, happier lives. And as always, you can find all the information about the TED Talks that we mentioned, plus my guests' books and socials, all on the podcast show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com. And when you're there, you can sign up to the newsletter, Eat, Read, Watch, where I share three things that I think are going to help you live a healthier, happier life, whether it's something to eat, whether it's something to listen to, whether it's a talk on gratitude, whether it's a video that makes you laugh, something that will lift your spirit as well as nourish your bellies. On to the podcast. Well, before we dive into the topic, why smart people make bad food choices, I want to know a bit more about yourself. I mean, you've had like quite an incredible career. You mentioned at the start of some of your written work about how much you've traveled and experienced different food systems and spoken to a number of different organizations across Europe and Asia. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a small town in southern Indiana, which is big farm country, mostly cornfields. We weren't in farming, but my family, we had a family garden, but it wasn't like gardens today. We had corn and peppers and green beans and cantaloupes and watermelon and tomatoes. And, we basically, my mother canned everything. I tell people we were basically subsistence farmers. And it was all organic because we had child labor, which was me and my brothers. But I didn't really think of that as farming because I knew what a real farm looked like. And it wasn't really until years later that I looked back on that and I thought, wow, you know, that was actually a pretty unusual experience. And I was much closer to food and agriculture than I realized, you know, at the time and for actually many years later. But that was my introduction to food. I mean, I never really thought that I would end up working in the food sector, having done that growing up. But what my real interest was, you know, is global environmental issues. You know, I spent 2 years in Africa in the Peace Corps and, you know, sort of left with this passion for how do we protect the world's forest. And that led me to the U.S. Department of State, where I quickly realized instead of working on sort of environmental policy, I should be working on agriculture policy because the biggest driver of all the problems I was concerned about was agriculture. And so if we could fix agriculture, the other problems would just go away.
Mm-hmm. And did you do that for the majority of your career, would you say, in your roles in the US system?
Yeah. So, you know, My studies were environmental science and law and biology and chemistry and psychology and stuff. But, you know, I spent 13 years with the U.S. Department of State. So a few years covering Africa food policy, then Asia food policy, then Europe food policy. Then I ran our global biotechnology program. And then my last few years, my only job was giving speeches. So I had the unlimited travel budget. I could go anywhere in the world and just talk about the future of food, the role of science, and how do we better communicate. So good preparation for this.
Yeah, that's amazing. And where would you say have you seen some of the best practices and considering so much international experience that you have?
Well, you know, there are lessons almost anywhere you go. You know, you can find things that people are doing right. You know, unfortunately, there's so many things that are being done wrong. But what I was really left with was the impression that things aren't as bad as most people think. You know, we tend to look at deforestation and, you know, obviously that's a problem. And we look at eutrophication of waterways and that's a problem. But we forget where we've come from. And so just give you an example, you know, agriculture in the United States, to produce a bushel of corn, we produce 35% fewer greenhouse gases today than we did in 1980 to produce it. We use 40% less land. We have 50% less water. And there's 60% less erosion to produce that food. And that would be true of every single crop. So things are actually wildly better than they were in the past. The problem is we're producing a lot more food. And so you just see the problems. You don't see like how much better they are. And, you know, that's true everywhere. You know, if we were farming today with 1960s technology, we would need 1 billion additional hectares of land, which is more than a quarter of all the forest on the planet. So, you know, you don't see forests that didn't get cut down. You know, you only, you know, think about the ones that do.
Yeah. And not to get too off topic here, but I guess most people are coming around to the idea about the differences in climate change, the increasing temperatures, a lot of which can be attributed to agriculture. Whether it be the transportation, whether it be the methods of agriculture, but like you just said, the way in which we produce food is actually a little bit more efficient, or a lot more efficient than it was. So, is it purely down to the amount of food that we're having to produce, and is there an imbalance between what we are producing versus how much we need?
Well, you know, there are trade-offs. So we, you know, we do produce, you know, like three times as much food as we did, you know, back in the 60s, but, you know, population has increased and people's incomes have increased. And so, you know, food demand has risen faster than, you know, population alone. And so without that productivity gain and those production gains, you know, we wouldn't have gone from a third of all the people on the planet going to bed hungry 50 or 60 years ago to less than 10% today. So certainly 800 million people going to bed hungry is a problem, but, you know, things are not bad and getting worse. They're good and getting better, but not fast enough. And that's a very different framing of the problem, because are farmers the problem to be solved or the solution to the problem? And how you talk about it determines whether people work with you or work against the solutions you're trying to provide. And that's sort of true in the stuff that we're going to talk about as well.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, actually, it reminds me of one of the links that you suggested that I haven't actually watched yet. The TED talk on, by the statistician who talks about actually how much better things have become over the last couple of decades compared to what we're bombarded with via the media. Being, you know, we've only got 60 years left of harvest land, you know, everything is full of pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. So it gives like a cloud over our food system that actually, in reality, is actually much more improved than it was. And, you know, we're sort of pinpicking, we're nitpicking at certain things that certainly need to improve, but are certainly not the main story.
Yeah, Hans Rosling, you know, he's great. You know, obviously he's passed away now, but his book Factfulness, you know, is something that, you know, people should read because it doesn't hide the problems, but I think it gives us hope. And today, I think that some of the problems still feel so overwhelming that it can lead people to despair that, you know, nothing they do matters, when in fact, everything they do matters. And if we all do it, things will be just fine.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Well, let's talk about the body of work that you've put into this book, right? So, you know, my impression of the book is it's basically about how we can work with our natural impulses and knowledge of human psychology, heuristics, biases, and everything else to address public health concerns. And the one that we are addressing today is obviously healthy food choices and lifestyle choices. And there is a quote in the book that I had to write down because it just spoke to me so much. It's, in an increasingly interconnected and complicated world, the willingness to revise our views is more critical than ever. And I've actually been talking about this with a few colleagues and some other people that work in the sort of realm of social media, because it feels that we've lost the ability to hold two conflicting ideas at once. And you're either in one camp or you're in another. And you see that play out quite clearly in diet wars. But this context, this concept of intellectual humility is fascinating for me. I wonder if we could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, and you know, that's how I lead off the book, because I want people to approach this with a sense of, you know, wonder and learning and excitement. And, you know, too often we approach things that, you know, maybe we're not sure that we agree with such a skeptical look that we end up, you know, deciding that we're not going to support it or we're not going to change our mind before we've even really given it a chance. And, you know, I think that that's really important, because we're not going to make any big improvements if we don't change the mindset with which we approach the problem. And, you know, it's the old thing, the thinking that got us into the problem is not going to get us out of the problem. And, you know, that's difficult for people, changing their minds about something that's like really important to their core values. You know, we just don't do that as often as I think, you know, we wish we would. You know, we all think we're open-minded, but then, you know, we really can't even remember the last time we changed our minds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, when you wrote that, I was like, I don't actually know the last time I've changed my mind on something in the last 6 or 12 months. Nothing really. Like, I mean, can you think of anything?
You know, maybe not 6 or 12 months, but, you know, I can't. One of the big things that sort of does go to my core, you know, I spent a lot of time working on biotechnology and genetically modified crops. And I was very focused on, you know, we need to increase yields, because I was focused on the people in Africa and other places that just didn't have enough food. And I felt like things like organic food were just a bit of a luxury. And, you know, they tend to be less productive because you're not using as many inputs, you know, which is not surprising. And so I felt like it wasn't really a solution, and it was a distraction from some of the things. And over time, I've actually come to understand the role and the place of something like organic. And what I found fascinating when I realized was that they're solving problems in ways that the big food system never would. And because of that, they came up with things like cover crops, planting crops between growing seasons, because they sort of believed in their hearts it was the right thing to do. But then big data came along and proved them right. And so I realized that, you know, maybe 95% of agriculture shouldn't be organic, but it's a really good thing that 5% of agriculture is organic, because our system is more resilient because of its diversity. And so, you know, that was something that was like, you know, I spent a lot of time talking about these issues. And so it was a big wake up for me that, you know, I had had, you know, I was too focused as well.
Yeah. That's such a really good point, because I used to think that about yield versus the quality of the crops and crop rotations. And I'm still very infant in my understanding of regenerative agriculture, but I feel like it might be the intuitive and then pragmatic way to go. Do you have an opinion on regen movement?
Well, so there are two different versions of regenerative agriculture. There's the organic plus, where it's like even more, you know, hard to do. And you know, if organic's 5% of agriculture and regen is only 1% of that 5%, well, it's never going to have an impact, you know, because it's just too small, unless the ideas scale. The other view of regen is that our sort of bigger intensive farms should be measuring their outputs and providing metrics to make sure they're getting better, and that they should worry about soil health and water quality and all these things instead of just yield. You know, I think that that has a lot of role to play. I generally think of it in terms of local sustainability versus global, and local is what consumers think about: less water, less fertilizer, less pesticides equals good, but it also means less production, which means more land, which means more deforestation. On the other hand, intensive agriculture means more nutrient runoff, and it's worse for that piece of land, but we need fewer pieces of land. And so sort of global sustainability is sort of bad for the land, but good for the planet. And local sustainability is good for that land, but not as good for the planet. And they're just trade-offs between the two. So we shouldn't think of one as good and one as bad. We should think about where should we be using one and where should we be using the other.
We're going to come to this in a bit about decision fatigue, but considering you know so much about the food landscape, I'm really intrigued as to how you personally shop and how you choose vegetables and eat yourself. Like, what are your shopping habits like, considering you know so much about this?
Well, you know, my wife and I, we tend to cook a lot. You know, we have the luxury of being able to do that. And, you know, we go and we buy lots of fruits and vegetables. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time sort of, you know, learning to make those vegetables better, you know, and how to do that. And so I'm sort of constantly thinking about, you know, what can we do to make it easier for us to do it? So, like, I'm a huge proponent of like frozen and canned and other things, because, you know, we shouldn't stigmatize those things, because we know that the nutrients in frozen can be as nutritious, if not more, than fresh. And so I'm worried that, you know, by saying, you know, it's like, oh, I always cook fresh or use fresh fruits and vegetables, that I'm stigmatizing the other stuff. And for many people, you know, it's just easier to use frozen, or, you know, that it fits within their budget or other things. And so I don't want to be elitist in how I approach it, you know, just because I have some luxuries that not everybody does. But, you know, for me, it's, you know, it's spending the time, you know, I've worked with my kids, you know, we always cook together, and hopefully that's something that they'll take with them as they head off into the world.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that really resonates with me, because I think even though I have the luxury of going to a farmer's market every Saturday, that is literally down the road from me, or having multiple options, plus the mechanism to have groceries delivered to me in 15 minutes because I'm in the center of London, you know, it doesn't mean that I have to make time trade-offs as well. So if I'm coming back from work and it's late, I always have stuff in my freezer, whether it's peas, whether it's sweet corn, whether it's berries, whether it's, you know, canned foods, as well as the stuff in jars and ferments and stuff like that, because you need to be able to cook nutritious food on the go as well. And you're right, you know, we don't want to marginalize or stigmatize people who don't have those luxuries. But it's just interesting to find out how people shop themselves, considering they sort of work and they live in this this arena.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we need to meet people where they are and then help them to be their better selves.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, cool. So on information overload, let's define some of the concepts that we're going to be talking about. So I've mentioned heuristics, cognitive biases, and confirmation bias, that sort of constant themes that come throughout the book. Maybe we should define exactly what those three things actually mean.
Yeah, so a heuristic is, you know, just a way that we solve common problems that allows us to sort of short circuit the thinking process. You know, we don't want to always have to think long and hard. You know, so it's like when you get in the car and you sort of arrive at your office and you can't even really remember how you got there, but your mind was on automatic pilot. So heuristics are like these automatic pilots that make decisions for us every day. And a cognitive bias is sort of when those heuristics go wrong and they lead to a consistent but incorrect outcome. And, you know, perhaps the one that people know the most is confirmation bias, the idea that we seek out information that's consistent with our beliefs and we sort of discount information that's inconsistent. But I suspect for most people, we are incredibly good at identifying bias in others, and we are remarkably bad at identifying bias in ourselves.
Yeah. I'm certainly more aware of my confirmation bias over the last couple of years because I can feel it myself. It's like I get a dopamine rush whenever I read an article that confirms my ideas about how we should, you know, change our food landscape for the betterment of human health. So whenever I read an article that is saying something positive about an ingredient or a particular dietary type, whether it's the Mediterranean diet or, you know, a new RCT, my brain is lighting up. I mean, my brain was probably lighting up as I was reading your book, actually. But you know, that's just like lighting up my confirmation biases. If I see something that's negative or neutral, I'm more inclined to discard it or, you know, just not bring that on board. Whereas I'm trying to train myself to be better at that. And I think it's just, you know, the effect of wanting to help people as much as possible and, you know, have something positive to say about stuff.
Yeah. So when I'm, you know, speaking to audiences, and I do a lot of public speaking, I give an example of my own bias, you know, and I'll use the example of organic. I say, you know, if I read an article that said organic is more nutritious than conventional agriculture, what would I do? I'd ask, who are the authors, who funded the research, and what was their methodology? Pretty reasonable things to do. On the other hand, if the article had said organic, no more nutritious than conventional, what would I have done? Tweeted it, right? Because yeah. It's consistent with what I believe. I'm sure their methodology is fine. You know, these guys seem totally legit. And that's the difference. I mean, it seems perfectly reasonable to ask those questions, and yet you don't of the things that agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So heuristics are really interesting, right? So they're sort of like rule of thumbs, things that you just automatically do. You pick something up that's on sale, for example, or you have a heuristic that a Volvo is the most reliable car, whatever that might be defined by.
An example of that would be like the availability heuristic. So like when somebody says a word, what things come to mind? So when I say the word natural, you know, you're thinking butterflies and rainbows and puppies. You're not thinking Ebola and E. coli and Salmonella, which are all perfectly natural as well. And so we all just go to a happy place when we hear the word natural, even though it doesn't actually mean anything in a food context.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the context of decision fatigue, the sort of more decisions we make, the worse our judgment becomes. And this is particularly relevant in the context of a modern supermarket where you're bombarded by lots of different options, as well as the information on said options as well, whether it's, like you said, natural or plant-based or low fat. So how do we avoid this situation that is oh so common and occurs every single day or every single time someone goes into the store?
Yeah. So decision fatigue is a subset of mental fatigue. And so just when we're tired, we make bad decisions. So that could be at the end of a long day, you know, after picking up the kids, you know, all of these things, you know, we're tired. And so on top of that, you know, then the more decisions you have to make when you're tired, they're going to get even worse. And there's just no place where you have to make more decisions than a grocery store. A grocery store today has literally tens of thousands more products than a grocery store in 1980. So, you know, it's the situation has gotten so much worse than it ever was before. And, you know, so you're going through and you're trying to make decisions. And then if you're sort of higher income, you know, maybe you're just choosing the Parmigiano or Reggiano and it's, you know, it's easy. But, you know, if you're on a fixed food budget, you know, it's like, oh, or do I choose the Kraft or do I choose the store brand? You know, there are actually a lot more things you have to figure out. And so you're in a worse financial position and you're even, you know, tougher. So there are a lot of common things I think, you know, we can do. There's the, you know, don't, you know, go in the morning, you know, before you're tired, go with a list to ensure that the things that you buy, shop around the edges where, you know, there's maybe more whole fresh foods and less of the processed foods. So that's one half of it. The other half though, is what is the grocery store doing to shape the choices I make? And I think we spend very little time thinking about that, but, you know, why is there candy at the checkout? Well, you're tired now. You're going to grab one. You know, why are there things on the end caps? You know, how has the design of the grocery store been laid out? Is it to maximize the healthfulness of the basket of food I buy, or is it to maximize the profit of the grocery store? Now, you can't really blame people for choosing the latter. But in the UK right now, you know, you have grocery stores actually redesigning their layout and have demonstrated they can increase by 10 or 15% the amount of fruits and vegetables that people buy just by changing the layout. And, you know, that's a fantastic thing because consumers don't even know that they're changing. They're just walking out of the store with a better basket of goods.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see more big time retailers move into this wellness space. And I've read a few consumer reports looking at how much investment is going into layouts and redesigning supermarket stores with the exact outcome that you're describing there. Where you're putting more fruits and vegetables into the baskets and you're having less processed foods. I think we always need a bit of a healthy skepticism of all these different practices, because at the end of the day, they are there to profit maximize. And one of the easiest ways to do that is on the high margin items, which happen to be more processed as a rule of thumb. So I guess, like, you know, one of the things that we need to do is also educate the consumer, like you said, about how to navigate the complex world of a supermarket shelf. I read this book by Barry Schwartz. I think it was published a few years ago, called The Paradox of Choice. And it's about this paradox of how, you know, we've got even more choices, yet we actually are unhappy. And we have less pleasure from the shopping experience. Is that in part due to decision fatigue, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're related. But, you know, the idea that just when we have too many choices, we feel like we may be making the wrong one. And so that's a little different than decision fatigue. But the two, you know, combine to one, we're less happy and we're making worse decisions. So, it, you know, again, it's sort of the worst of all worlds. And, you know, this is a lot of the things that I'm tackling in the book, is how do we maximize our joy and, you know, pleasure in food and be healthy at the same time? And so I think both of those concepts are critically important.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned a study in the book. I can't remember the exact name of the study who did it, but I just wrote it down as the milkshake study, where it described what we believe about the food that we're about to consume. And just that belief system is super powerful for how satiated we are afterwards, or what we feel about it, or how much we enjoyed it. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, you know, everybody should have a favorite research study, right? That, like, and Mind, the name of the article is Mind Over Milkshakes, which is the chapter of the book, and it's by Dr. Alia Krum, who has a TED talk in which she actually talks about this. And, you know, the amazing thing was that, you know, I think we all know that there's a lot of research that shows, like, if you put low fat on a label and ask consumers to, you know, evaluate it, they will not enjoy it as much, even if it isn't low fat. So the thought that it could be diminishes the experience. This happens with, sodium in soup. If you tell people you've reduced the sodium, they just won't like it as much, even if it actually tastes in blind taste tests just as good. But she wanted to test something different. So she gave a group of people a milkshake that was, a Sensa shake. It was a sensible shake that had, like 150 calories. And then at the same time, they measured the ghrelin level to sort of see how did the body respond to that. And so then the same people came back a week later, and this time they got this indulgent shake. They had like 650 calories. And they measured the levels of, the hormone that, indicates sort of when you begin to digest your food and how full you are, satiation. And what she found is that they felt three times more satiated when they ate the milkshake that they thought was higher in calories, even though it was exactly the same shake. And so this is fascinating. It's not just that they reported feeling, but their body physiologically responded as if they had gotten a different product. And this, I think, is critical because you begin to realize that this happens every day. Like you eat the Weight Watchers meal. Well, your body is probably not going to respond as if you had enough calories, even if you do. And so like all the things we do in order to like cut back and, be healthier, our body is physiologically not responding in the way that we would hope that it would. And so you almost have to trick your body into thinking that it's not eating healthier, but being healthier. And so it creates all these interesting questions of how food companies can help us and how we can help ourselves.
Yeah, I love that. So the framing of food and how you describe said food is super important when it comes to how satiated you feel. And that's kind of one of the reasons why whenever I do my cookbooks and stuff, I'm really cautious about how the title invites the user to want to cook the dish rather than cook it out of, wanting to be puritanical. So instead of me calling a chickpea dish, healthy, low-fat chickpea dish, I'm going to be saying, this is masala infused with rose petals and harissa, whatever else I've put in there. So it sounds indulgent, the image looks indulgent, and you actually want to eat it. And it has those health benefits baked into it, even if you're not consciously aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really important is the mindset. And that's really what she's getting at as well. I mean, there's been interesting research that if people think that they're getting exercise, their body actually begins to improve its health levels as well. And so she talks about that in her TED talk as well, that, and there they look at, housekeepers who are like on their feet all day. And when they are told that it's like, well, no, that's actually exercise, then their blood pressure actually goes down and all of these things associated with exercise, improve, even though their behavior didn't change. It's their mindset that changed about the work they do.
Yeah, that I mean, that stuff just blows my mind about the power of just how you're communicating, whatever it might be, the activity, the food you're consuming, the milkshake, and how that has a dramatic effect on the end result. I think, there's definitely something in there beyond the placebo effect. And if it has that beneficial outcome, that's something that we really need to look into, I guess, when it comes to designing food landscapes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another story that I loved it. I mean, it was full of stories, the book. It was great. There's so many that I'd love to chat about. But the rise of jumbo popcorn, how America has like huge portion sizes and how that kind of stems from the popcorn element. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was really surprised that our penchant for, jumbo sizes all goes back to the mad genius of one man, David Wallerstein, back in the 1960s. And he was working for a movie theater chain, and his job was to get people to eat more popcorn and more concessions. And he tried 2-for-1 deals and all sorts of things. And he just couldn't get people to come back and buy a second bag. And then he finally hit on him. Well, what if people are embarrassed to go back for a second bag? I might look gluttonous to my friends and my neighbors and people are watching. And so that's when he offered the jumbo size. And of course, sales took off, but also sales of soda and other things. And, everything changed. And of course, What really changed was then he later went on to work for McDonald's Corporation, and he had this conversation with Ray Kroc, and he's like, hey, you need to offer larger sizes. And Ray Kroc's like, nah, people want a second bag of fries, they'll just go buy a second bag of fries. And they went back and forth, and it wasn't until 1972 that he finally convinced Ray Kroc that they should offer a large size fry. And of course, the rest is history.
Yeah. It's, and there's a chart, I think, that basically chronicles just how big the portions have become over 50 or 60 years. And, I remember vividly going to America when I was a child with my mum, my dad, my sister, and we went to the buffet. And the portions that they would give us, I mean, the size of the plates and everything were just absolutely massive when we ordered off menu as well as on the buffet as well. And so it's kind of been baked into my psychology that Americans eat just generally larger portions. But how recent that trend was, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you mean, you look at some of the data and, back before the 1970s, obesity rates in the United States were lower than in many places in Europe. It's just things have changed dramatically and, within a lifetime.
Yeah. So that in a sense is, again, some extra information about how the food landscape really does dictate the health and well-being of the population. So now we can talk a bit more about some examples of deliberate food landscape architecture and how that can impact people's choices. It's sort of this concept of liberal paternalism that everyone might have heard about through the book Nudge that you recommend in there in your book as well. Why don't we look at Google as an example? Because I think that's a fantastic testing ground for people to know a bit more about how this can be put into action.
Yeah. And, just let me mention that, part of what brought me to this question was, I was really confused as to why is it, at a time when we know more about health and nutrition than we ever have in the history of the planet, and we've never been more obese, and we have more healthy food options in a grocery store than we've ever had, and we've never been more obese. So it's like, if you have more information and you have more access, something's like really strange going on. And, it's not like we had more willpower in the past than we do today. In 1960, our parents were cooking with lard. So it's like, and yet somehow nobody was obese. It's not that one thing has changed, it's that everything has changed. And, one company that is really sort of at the cutting edge of applying behavioral science is Google. And, we don't think of Google in terms of food, but they have a couple hundred thousand employees around the world. And before COVID, they were feeding them one, two, or three meals a day, and they were giving free food to them. And it's like some of the best food in the world, And what happened is that they were one of the first, tech companies to offer this luxury good food. And it led to the Google 15. People started gaining weight, which, wow, you give people free food and snacks and somehow they're gaining weight. What a remarkable discovery. But they wanted to do something about it. And so they started trying to figure out, we don't want to take away the snacks and we don't want to, not give away the food. So what could we do? And, they began to sort of play with this idea of behavioral science. Well, what if we took the M&Ms and we put them in opaque containers? So, that just makes it a little harder to, it's there, but you might not grab it. What if we take the sodas and instead of putting them in front of through clear glass, we put them behind frosted glass and in a lower refrigerator? And we put the spa water and everything all around so people can get it. What if when they go to the coffee station, instead of turning around and grabbing a snack while your coffee is brewing, we move it 20 feet away? And now that's a little too far to walk while your coffee is there. So people just reduce their snacking. And so they did all of these different nudges, the buffet line. Well, let's start with the vegetables. And, by the time you get to, the desserts or the meat or other things, your plate is hopefully full. And, it's a smaller plate. And instead of offering four desserts a day, well, what if we just offer one? It's like, so they're applying and then they're measuring it all. And, that's what's, it's because that's what Google does best is, so now they've got big data. And so while not every company has the ability to do all of these things, they're able to then share that information with the world. So they've worked with the Yale Center for Consumer Customer Insights. They work with Compass Group, which is like one of the largest food service companies in the world. And so then Compass can take those ideas to the hospitals and schools and corporate cafeterias around the world and apply those lessons on how to nudge people to have healthier outcomes. And, you know, it's pretty exciting, you know, how you can take ideas, test them and iterate, you know, because that's what's important. You know, they've done, you know, 100 years of research in the last decade because, you know, they've got the ability to test things more quickly.
I wonder if those elements of deliberate food landscape architecture are directly transferable to different environments. So, you know, we're mentioning Google, and I think everyone's got this idea of the Google canteen of just being full of academics and coders and, you know, incredible mathematicians, which there are. I remember going to the Google canteen, the one in Ireland, and it was amazing. I could get everything, Indian food, British, American food, whatever I wanted, it was there. It was amazing. But that's a specific sort of subset of the population. I wonder how malleable or nudgeable other people are in different environments, like children, schools, public arenas, that sort of thing. Is it directly transferable? Do we know about any data from that?
Yeah, and it is transferable. And I mean, a lot of the reason they're doing it at Google is because there was already good research to suggest that these things work. So, you know, placement in, you know, the cafeteria, you know, what comes first, what comes last, what's at eye level, what's not, where is the salad bar? You know, so there had been research that had been done in lots of different areas. And so, yeah, it's definitely applicable to many parts of our lives, and it's applicable to our own home as well.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you about the own home because you know, whilst we're waiting for supermarkets to do that here in the UK or in different areas, or we're waiting for the National Health Service to stop pushing around the trolley with all the snacks and stuff in it in patient waiting rooms, that really infuriates me whenever I'm working. What can we do in our own homes that can essentially create a healthier nudging environment that optimizes for lifestyle change and protects against more unhealthy options?
Yeah. So, you know, if you don't buy a snack, you won't eat it. And so if it's not in the home, you know, if you buy the snack, you know, leave it in the cupboard, you know, behind closed doors, don't leave it on the countertop. If you leave it on the countertop, put it inside a jar. Yeah. You know, so they're just different things you can do along to add just a little bit of friction to the process. And so it's not about denying yourself, you know, pleasures, in fact, it's just the opposite. It's allow us to enjoy our indulgences without guilt, because they're not contributing to an unhealthy outcome. They're part of a healthy and nutritious diet. And so they're the little things. And, you know, we talk about smaller plates, and smaller plates can work. The problem is that, you know, if there's dissonance, if you're using, you know, a 9-inch or a 7-inch plate at home, and then you go to the restaurant, it's a 13-inch plate. So then all of a sudden the plate at home doesn't feel like it's big enough. So that's where as many things as we can do at home, they're not going to work as well as they could if they're not consistent in the different places that we eat. And so that's why a lot of these ideas need to transition to restaurants and get them on board with helping to support our healthier outcomes. And it's not that I blame the restaurants. You know, we go back to restaurants that give us big portions. You know, we don't go to restaurants that, you know, we feel are skimping with their food. But if we could find a way to work with the restaurant, and, you know, I often use Cheesecake Factory as an example, because here in the US, they're known for enormous portion sizes. But, you know, what if you went into the restaurant and you said, you know, I'd like half of that to go. And so when they serve you the food, they give you your to-go bag, and you don't have to clear your plate. You don't have to put half of it aside, you know, and that way you can finish your plate. And that's important, so that your brain thinks, I finished my meal. If you only eat half the food, your brain is not going to respond as if you're done eating. And so you're going to be hungry, you know, 2 hours later, even though you ate more than enough food. And so we need to find ways of, making sure that you get consistent messages in different places, because we need that kind of reinforcement for these things to become habits.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the best things that I've done in terms of choice architecture for my own kitchen and home is making sure that I always have something in the freezer that's already pre-made. So Me and my partner will make like a big ragu at the weekend, or like a bean soup or something that is very easily portioned out into containers that are freezable. And so if I'm coming back late and I have that temptation, oh, I could just get a takeout, or oh, I could just get one of the like a ready meal or something that is, you know, healthier ready meal or whatever, there is always that temptation. Even someone like me who loves to cook and loves to, you know, put things together, when you're that tired, you're going to default to the easiest option, which generally happens to be the unhealthy one. So having that in my freezer kind of gives me a backup. And it just reduces the barriers to consistently eating a way that is in line with my health goals.
Yeah, food prep is great. You know, doing things on the weekends if you have more time. But then there's also just recognizing that often when we get up and we go for a snack, we're not doing it because we're hungry. We're doing it because we're bored. And, you know, sort of that awareness of it's like I'm wandering through the kitchen. You know, it's like, you know, do you really need something to eat, or could you go for a walk, or maybe you need to read a book or read the newspaper? So much of it, you know, isn't about the food itself. It's about the activity, and, you know, that habits, you know, are important. Instead of walking to the kitchen, you know, you walk out the front door, and that can help as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I know it's unfair to compare the unhealthy food choices that we have to smoking, because, you know, food is more about culture and, you know, memories, and it, obviously it's a source of enjoyment and something that's healthy, but it can have those detrimental impacts if we are eating in an unhealthy manner for a long period of time. But in terms of what's had the biggest impact on reducing smoking rates, would you say it is the packet warnings, or the removal of ads, or the fact that it's banned in public spaces? What do you think across the spectrum of different activities that we put in at a governmental level had the biggest impact on in smoking? Is there anything that we can learn about that practice to how we can create healthier options for people in the environment in terms of food?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, the warnings on the package haven't had as much of an impact, just because, you know, if you smoke and you see, you know, there's some place countries where they have like the diseased lungs or something like that, you know, which is just awful, is that, you know, somebody looks at that, and if they continue to smoke, they have to sort of convince themselves that that's not them. And so it's like we're very good at ignoring information that we don't want to. But I do think that making it a little bit harder to smoke in public places, or making it less socially acceptable, you know, ultimately has a big impact on what people do. And that's, you know, why many people, even smokers, just don't even smoke in their own homes anymore, because they have taken on this idea themselves. It's very different with food. And I think we need to be very cautious about doing something that stigmatizes the people that, you know, may be overweight, because, you know, it's society and culture and other things that are leading to these outcomes. And, you know, so we don't want to stigmatize the people. What we might stigmatize or, you know, focus more on the restaurants that are providing the bigger portions, but not to stigmatize them either, because, you know, people come back because of that, but we need to work with them. So I think the solutions are going to be quite different. You know, raising the price of cigarettes, I'm sure that had an impact on many, but raising the price of food is very different, you know, because, you know, it would be a regressive tax. It would hit the poorest people the most. And it's not that simple. You know, there have been a lot of efforts to like focus on soda taxes. And, you know, which, you know, does anybody need half a gallon of soda? Probably not. On the other hand, soda consumption in America is at a 30-year low. So it feels like that must be a big part of the problem. But then when you dig into the numbers, it's like, well, sugar consumption is actually going in the other direction. And that's already a societal trend. You know, maybe you can accelerate that. But if we're getting, you know, more and more obese and we're eating less and less sugar, are we tackling the right problem or tackling it in the right way? And so I think, you know, there are definitely questions as to whether or not those are going to deliver the outcomes that we want. And ultimately, it's about making people healthier, not, you know, just undermining or stigmatizing unhealthy food. Because, you know, there is, in a sense, there's no unhealthy food. They're just unhealthy diets. Because, you know, you can eat anything you want if it's part of a healthy diet, and you would be just fine.
Yeah. We've spoken about obesity in a couple of podcasts, actually. And I think one of the issues in terms of stigmatizing people who are overweight is the lack of awareness of just how many other factors beyond excess calorie diets can impact someone's likelihood of being obese and struggling to lose weight as well. So, you know, there are genetic factors, there are gender factors, there are even some viruses that have been identified as having an impact on one's ability to partition fuel, as well as the microbiota, and, you know, the list goes on. So there's a number of reasons why we need to better educate the general public and as to why obesity is an issue in today's day and age. And I think the other side of that is really looking at ways in which to design environments where the healthy options are the default, which you've talked about a lot in your book. And I just wonder, you know, you've talked about envisioning a future where nobody counts calories, nobody reads diet books and all that kind of stuff. Is that realistic? Is that something? Because I think we're always going to have some sort of interest in food, because it's like one of these magical activities that we do 2 to 3 times a day. People always want to talk about food. Most of the programs on the BBC and Channel 4 are about food. We're obsessed with food in the UK, as I'm sure it's the same in the States and other countries. Is that something that you see happening?
So I think it's definitely possible. You know, I think to some extent there's a overemphasis on the genetics and the human factors. And I think part of the reason is that, you know, we forget that genetics probably account for a large amount of obesity, just like genetics accounts for our height. But 50 years ago, people in Japan were 10 inches shorter than they are today. Genetics still accounted for 90% of their height, but they had a different diet. So when you know, people today, genetics are really important, but people 50 years ago, genetics was important too when they weren't obese. And so like we're focusing on something that wasn't the difference between then and now. It's the environment that is different from between then and now. And so the, you know, idea is that we didn't gain 50 pounds in 1 year. We certainly didn't gain it in 6 to 12 weeks. And so the idea that that's how we're going to lose weight, I think just doesn't really make any sense. And, you know, 50 years of dieting and diet research suggests that, you know, no diet works for lots of reasons you've talked about on your show before. But what could work is redesigning our food environment so that we lost 1 or 2 or 3 pounds a year for the next 30 years. And 30 years from now, we're 50 pounds lighter and we have no idea how we got there. And yet somehow these tweaks in our environment delivered that outcome. And, you know, that's what was happening up until the 1960s, that, you know, our environment just wasn't delivering obesity in the way that it is now. So, yeah, I do think that, you know, we can begin to reshape our food environment. You know, if it was just about, you know, sugar is an addictive, you know, is just as addictive as heroin, you know, you know, if you read Michael Moss's, you know, book or something, well, then people with more money can afford to buy more food. So shouldn't they be more obese? And yet, of course, the wealthier you are, the healthier you tend to be. So that correlation doesn't hold at all. And so, you know, understanding what's different, well, their food environment is different for wealthier people. You know, they have access to more healthy food. They have more time in order to enjoy it. You know, there are all sorts of things that aren't about the addictiveness of food in order to answer or explain that. And so we really have to take this community approach. And that's where things like Blue Zones and Wellville by Esther Dyson and others, I think, are beginning to help us realize just how important community and family and other things are to delivering healthy outcomes.
Yeah. If I'm playing devil's advocate, the thing I worry about is we've gone so far in creating an amazing array of choices, an incredible vast array of different food stuffs that are ultra high processed and very profitable for a lot of people. It will be quite hard to dismantle that food environment such that it is something that is a lot more enticing for, or a lot easier for people to live a healthy life in, particularly in the most vulnerable areas, which are the poorer areas, where those food offerings are often targeted at them, whether it be a cheap incentive, a price sensitivity, or time incentive. So that's my only concern about. It's great to have a grand vision. It's great to have, you know, examples like Google and Compass Group and a whole bunch of other caterers who are looking at ways in which to redesign certain areas, but doing that on the grand scale, how achievable is that? I know we need to start everywhere. I don't want to be a naysayer, but, you know, it's just something that does play on me a bit.
Yeah, well, and I understand, you know, why it seems overwhelming, because there isn't one thing to do. There's 1,000 things to do. The problem is that, you know, the counterfactual, it's like, well, you know, diets don't actually work. And the more we know about nutrition, the further we get from how people actually eat. And so a lot of the research that we're doing is becoming more and more detailed, but it's becoming less and less relevant. And, you know, understanding our microbiome, I mean, people aren't eating the things they know they should eat. So why do we think coming up with, you know, some super nutritive superfood is going to change? You know, there's no superfood that can replace, you know, 4 to 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. So, you know, even if you eat a superfood, you still need, your 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. So much of what we're focused on, if it occurred, still wouldn't be expected to change the outcome. And so this is just part of, you know, the solution. You know, it's how we should think about it. But right now, there's almost no research going into how to, you know, convince restaurants and grocery stores and cafeterias to redo this. So, you know, we haven't really spent any time. You know, I'm constantly amazed how little effort is going into things that really won't cost the grocery store any more money. You know, maybe it has a little bit of an impact, but grocery stores today want to be seen as a wellness partner for their consumers. Restaurants more and more want to be seen as a healthy partner. Pretty much every big CPG company wants to be seen as a wellness partner. So I see this confluence of opportunity in order to actually measure it by healthy outcomes, not by health food products sold, you know, which is the current metric. I mean, if you sell more Weight Watchers and people get less healthy, you know, is that really a good measure of
success? It's not the desired outcome. Yeah, exactly. And to your point, you know, we've never been more informed about health and wellness, yet we are obese and we've never been unhealthier from a lifestyle point of view. So, you know, there's definitely a disconnect there with what is in line with corporates and what's creating the wealth versus actually what's going to be creating the social outputs as well that are going to be benefiting societies at large. So I think that's like a wider conversation. I mean, what are you working on at the moment in terms of what are your next steps with all this? I mean, obviously you've done a lot so far.
Yeah, so I work with the Google Food Lab, which is, you know, sort of thinking about how to scale outcomes that have impact. I work with different clients and companies and others that are trying to create sustainable supply chains. How do we not just to sell more product, but to deliver metrics that show that we're actually improving our system? You know, I tell people that my personal mission is to de-escalate the tension in our food system so that we can all get about our business of saving the planet in our own way. And so I like to work with people and organizations that are trying to make a difference and help them to scale that difference.
I love that. I love that. De-escalating the food wars and stuff. That's brilliant. I mean, it's something you might be interested in. I'm not too sure if you come across it, but in light of the NHS food review that was published this year, I think it was delayed from last year. I think it came out this year. They have something called the NHS Chef of the Year competition. And the reason why it came about is to sort of highlight excellence and some incredible individuals that have done some really good work in food catering, public sector catering, particularly in hospitals, because hostel food, I'm not too sure if it's the same in the US, but it's got a really bad reputation here in the NHS. And actually, when you look at certain areas across the country, you know, Sheffield, Lincolnshire, all the way down to Bristol, you know, there are some really incredible public sector caterers there. So we're trying to put a spotlight on that and actually reframe the the sort of concept of healthy hostile food. So you might be interested in that. I'll probably send you some stuff after this.
Well, one thing that Google did is that, you know, they found that, you know, people just don't really enjoy the vegetables that are being served, and that's one of the barriers to adoption. And so they worked with the Culinary Institute of America to create this 72-hour course on sort of how to make amazing vegetables. And, you know, one of the problems with the food world is that, you know, chefs, you know, when you're learning to be a chef, you know, you start on the vegetables and you eventually work your way up to the meat. And so it's like the lowest of the low. Instead of, you know, if the vegetables are amazing, then you'll fill up more of your plate with them. You know, I didn't know that I like Brussels sprouts until my wife, you know, baked them and seasoned them. And it was like, oh, this is actually really good. It's like, it's nothing like the, you know, the boiled Brussels sprouts that I had been been forced upon me. And so, you know, if we can make healthy food the desirable food, and this gets back into some of the habits, you know, we bribe our kids with dessert in order to get them to eat their vegetables instead of like fighting for the last piece of broccoli, you know, and sending signals to them that it's, you know, it's the best part of the meal. And so I think that there are lots of things that we can do that would, you know, have an impact, but not alone, you know, in combination with many other things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Jack, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time today. And I wish you well with all the future projects. And I'll be looking out for the Google Food Lab stuff as well. And do you guys create recipes out of that?
The Culinary Institute has their, I think it's called Plant Forward or something like that, a website where they are, you know, pushing out some of their lessons. Yeah.
Epic. I'll definitely look into that. I'm actually, I've created my food app at the moment, which is geared towards helping people eat well without really thinking about the whole process of ingredient searching and recipes. So we're going to be launching with around 250 to 300 recipes that you can get on your app. And it has step-by-step images plus the ability to one-shop click your ingredients, so you don't need to step foot into a supermarket and be bombarded with all these choices. You can just choose your recipes for the week and it just gets sent to you, or you can go to the market with the shopping list. So I'll definitely send that to you your way and get your opinions on that in the future.
No, that sounds great. 2019, my New Year's resolution was to learn to cook Indian food. And so, you know, then I spent the next 2 weeks, you know, going and buying, you know, a two dozen different ingredients, none of which I had in my house. So now I have a really good stock. So hopefully there's some good recipes there that can make use of these bulk items that I still have.
Oh, yeah, tons, loads of that. Mustard seeds, fennel seeds, cumin. There are definitely things that I use in a lot of my recipes. So you'll be spoiled for choice.
Sounds great.
Thank you so much for listening to the podcast today. Like I said at the start, you can get all this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com, and I will see you here next time.